I'll be speaking today about our carbon dioxide, our FACE project is south of the, in the southern hemisphere. It's the only ongoing FACE project in agriculture right now in the southern hemisphere. And its official name is the Australian Grains Free Air Carbon Dioxide Enrichment Project. I will be discussing the first 3 years of the project, which was on wheat exclusively. So I'll give some background and data on that. I will say that this has been with a collaboration with Melbourne University, and I work with the Department of Primary Industries, and we have a list of scientists on board who have collaborated in many different ways on the project. The project is still ongoing, by the way. One of the questions behind this in terms of the climate change issue is, what is the future of Australian wheat production? We know that carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere are rising, currently about 385 parts per million. The graphic in the bottom is from the latest IPCC report showing unprecedented rises in the principal greenhouse gases, including carbon dioxide. We know that temperature has been rising and was predicted to continue to rise. This is a map from the Bureau of Meteorology showing the last 37 years increase in temperature rise over much of the continent in Australia. Water availability is decreasing, especially in the southeast, which is where the project is located, and predicted to continue the trend. We all know that carbon dioxide, water, temperature are all main factors for impacting crop growth and development, yield and quality, et cetera. So what we want to do is, of course, understand the impact of these factors and, importantly, the interactions of these factors, which sort of define climate change and their effects on crops. Hopefully the crop models in the room will agree. We think we pretty much are pretty good in terms of modeling crop response under current conditions. We have lots of models out there, and we can say, well, we can model current yield based on certain inputs and factors and such. What we're not as good at is looking at future conditions under elevated CO2, and lots of discussion with my colleagues on how to improve those models and such. So what one of the objectives of this project is to provide or to work out and get validated prediction of grain response and in order to inform the industry and government for adaptation policies. So our approach to do this is to combine the experimental. The FACE project is in the field experiment, multi-factor experiment, elevated CO2 with a range of environments that are created for water, temperature, nitrogen, and cultivar. This allows us then to look at agronomic responses, differences in cultivars, look at grain quality, and a lot of this to inform pre-breeding programs in terms of traits that actually respond to elevated CO2. We have physiological measurements we take that help us explain some of those agronomic responses we see. We have soils questions. We're looking at carbon and nitrogen dynamics and cycling. And we have pests and diseases. It's one aspect of elevated CO2 that hasn't received very much attention, but in an open air situation, we're able to look at pests and disease dynamics. So this information set that gathered allows us then to validate crop models and give us some confidence that they work under the conditions we're seeing in the FACE project, that then allow us to link into landscape and climate change type of models to look ahead, look into the future. This allows us also, through the modeling effort, to include future climate issues of changes in temperature and rainfall patterns, and ultimately, again, to inform the industry and government. So how can we do this? Many of you, I'm sure, are quite familiar with FACE projects, but certainly you can study elevated CO2 by glasshouse research. Open-top chambers have been used. There are gradient tunnels and closed chambers. And finally, not last but least, the FACE methodology. As you can see, the FACE is, we call them rings, but they're really octals in this case. And each of those horizontal tubes has carbon dioxide that's emitted into the wind, which then carries it back across the ring. And a central sensor in the middle regulates and controls at the concentration of carbon dioxide within that ring structure. And we think and others think that this is the most realistic assessment of elevated CO2 in a field situation, because you don't have enclosures, you don't have any artifacts imposed. We have two sites, Horsham, which is the main site, and Walpiep, which we had, where we had a site for 2 years, in the main wheat growing belt in southeastern Australia. Up in the left is a aerial photo of the site from this past season on about 7.5 hectares. In the bottom, you see a ring obliquely there, and we have all our little plots inside there. And as I've stated, it's created, the rings create a series of environments within the elevated CO2 for not to study nitrogen, water, temperature variety, and soil type effects on those interactions at future 550 parts per million, which is where we expect the atmosphere to be in the year 2050. We look at agronomic and physiological effects on the lower range of the spectrum in terms of wheat production, lower rainfall, and yield production zones. Just real quickly, we have an ancillary project that looks at soil type. It's a soil face project. I won't be talking about that today, but we have a number of things going on. We, again, provides a validation data set for looks at the future levels of CO2 that allows crop modeling of yield and quality, and to inform government policy. And finally, to we also looking at the pest dynamics. Over the series of 3 years, we've actually had four separate physical structures. The first 2 years in our Horsham ag face on the left was a 12-meter ring, and we had two carbon dioxide levels with two times of sowing, which allows us to shift the crop into a later, hotter time of the year. It's one way of getting at the temperature question. Two levels of irrigation, two varieties, two nitrogen, four replications, and we sample three locations within each little plot at three, at stem elongation, anthesis, and at maturity. In 2009 and continuing, we have 16-meter rings, which allow us to have more varieties of wheat and actually also field pea we have this year. The soil phase project on the left with looks at soil type by CO2 interactions. And we had a second site at Walpiep, smaller rings, 4 meter, CO2 by time of sowing only. Some of the results, 2007, 8, and 9, three sampling times, actually should be stem elongation, anthesis, and maturity. ACO2 stands for ambient, E is elevated, so you've got your two CO2 levels there. Across the board, biomass was increased due to the elevated CO2 across our treatments. In the red, you see the final increase in percent of elevated CO2 over ambient in the 3 years, and we have a range of 20 to 30% increase in biomass production of the wheat. Its increases have been seen in other phase projects and chamber projects. That's not a big surprise. However, the level is. Other phase projects have seen 15 to 20% increases. We're seeing very consistently 20 to 30% increases in biomass in our project. Time of sowing, if you split all this out, it's in water treatment responses are what you would expect. More irrigation, more biomass, later time of sowing, less biomass relatively. But we also have other effects I won't go into here, but the tillering was enhanced by CO2, and we think that actually adds to some of the yield increases you see. More tillers, more seeds. Yield, down in the, you have Horsham 2007 and 8, and there are the times of sowing and irrigation rain fed are split out in there. In the top, you have our Walpiep site. Walpiep, I should say, was further north than the Horsham site in a drier, hotter environment in what's called the Mallee. And you can see a range of responses, and this is the response of elevated CO2 as a percent over the ambient, and ranging from about 6% up to 40, with an average around 27. The actual numbers in terms of yield range there from about 2 to 4.5 across those 2 years, and 1 to 2 tons per hectare in Walpiep. 2009, this is an older graph and I added to it, 50% overall increase, 32 here. So they fall in line with what we've seen in the first couple of years. The increase at Walpiep was hypothesized to be greater under elevated CO2 because of water use efficiency gains under elevated CO2 that were expected, although the soils data isn't quite in yet, so we're just a hypothesis at this point. Crop nitrogen and grain protein changes. Again, similar to what's been seen, if you look at grain protein in 2007, 8, and 9, grain protein contents reduce. At Walpiep, actually, they reduce, but the reduction is actually greater. And uptake is actually increased about 25% at Horsham, and 1 year of data we don't have yet, but 63% increase at Walpiep. We also saw over on the left a reduction in leaf and plant nitrogen content, but because you have the biomass increase, the actual total N uptake is greater under elevated conditions. Again, that's in line with what's been seen with other phase projects around the world. But the amounts are somewhat greater. Pests and diseases, wheat, striped rust, and crown rot were looked at within the project. And I guess the bottom line here is that for striped rust, there were no significant differences seen, and it's actually not expected to become a problem or may even be reduced in the future in terms of disease risk. However, if you look at crown rot, there were significantly and very significantly increased fungal biomass. This isn't necessarily infection rates, but certainly fungal biomass and growth of the fungus. And it's expected that this could become a disease that increases in the future, assuming you don't have varietal resistance developed. In terms of the modeling effort, taking those yield and biomass data out in trying to extrapolate, up in the left-hand corner there, we have observed days to anthesis and simulated. Circles aren't colored, but the face data from 2007 and elevated CO2 are actually in there. So they fall right on the line. And so the data from 2007 were used in the models to improve those models to be able to predict the future. And they're showing pretty good results. Biomass. Similarly, the 2007 Horsham data set is in there, colored darkly, and root mean square error for that prediction is 1.2 tons per hectare. My colleagues here assure me that that's well within the range of modeling error. And yield, similarly, at the bottom, we're showing that the models are can be improved to predict elevated CO2. Cutting out a few steps to get to this point, but going from the validated model, putting them into landscape and climate models. This is a downscaled CSIRO CCAM Mark III, which is the most recent model that CSIRO has for us. Up in the upper left corner, you see a map of Victoria and Australia. Thank you. Looking at historic data across the region, on the values there in blue are historic yields. Classed so you can see them easily in different colors. If you move this in this direction, look at the present-day situation. To the sowing date of the July 1st, you have that situation. Once you delay that sowing a little bit to a month to the 1st of August, you see the colors change. You have seen more greens and blues move down south, or you have so you're having increasing yields across the landscape by changing that time of sowing. If you take the July 1st historic data and look into the future with these models, then you also can see you see the change from the green into a bit more of the yellows, moving up again, an increase in yields predicted into 2050. If you're looking comparing the future scenarios one to another in terms of sowing date, you again see more increase as you move down into later sowing. So the question is, how will crops respond in the future? Well, you actually want to look this way, because what you have is current conditions. Looking ahead into the future, the greatest yield response will happen with long season cultivars by moving 1 month into the future in terms of sowing. So delay sowing later into the season with current cultivars will then increase the yield response across the landscape. Now, my colleagues point out that because of temperature rises and such, and the fact that crops will develop more quickly, our long-season varieties will actually become short-season varieties. And so there's a challenge there to the breeding community to sort of keep up with some of those changes. Summary, we saw increases in biomass and grain yield in the range of 25 to 30% at Walpip in the hotter, drier climate, 60%. In terms of current conditions. Both of those, by the way, result in about a half to one ton per hectare increase. Because you have lower yields in the north, higher, drier parts, that great increase still results in about the same amount of yield increase. You have the less response under time of sowing two. I didn't present that, but it's quite clear. And grain protein contents are lower with greater differences at the warmer sites. And uptake is much greater, and that has implications for nitrogen management. Little evidence of differences between our two cultivars, which were Jansen and Yitpe. They were sort of lumped together in terms of the results there. But this year in 2009, last year in 2009, I should say, we have many more varieties. I didn't present that data, but there are differences we're seeing between varieties in terms of responses to yield to elevated CO2. And what we do see, now just a hint at what's coming, is that we think the medium tillering varieties are actually more responsive to yield in the future than the high tillering or the low tillering ones. I can discuss that later. And then modeling, though, when you take all these and throw it into a future climate, although we're seeing under our current temperature and water regimes these increases in yield, by 2050, we'll see that up to about 10% yield losses in drier areas and gains in the southern areas where it's a bit wetter, 10 to 20%. But that depends on cultivar type and sowing date. I'd like to say that we're always looking for collaborations. And if are people interested in collaborating with us within the FACE facilities, we're always interested in exploring that option. And I'd like to thank our funders, the Grains Research Development Corporation and the Department of Agriculture, Forests and Fisheries in Australia. Thank you.
Any questions for the speaker?
Jeff?
first, a soft pitch.
Yes.
Did you see any effects of elevated CO2 on phenology?
We haven't seen that, actually. We haven't looked at it in depth yet, but certainly from the first year, we didn't see any differences.
Okay. If I could follow on, the other question is, if I got it right, you were seeing less response to CO2 under rain-fed than irrigated conditions?
In terms of the percent increase,
yeah.
Yes.
And isn't that the reverse of what people
yes.
have argued?
Yes, it is. What I also didn't present, our physiology scientists with the University of Melbourne are also, I'll show this to the soy face people when I see them, but we actually are seeing, we're not seeing the conductance trends that you would expect to see. In other words, the theory is that under elevated CO2, you see, lower conductance, but we're seeing higher conductance. The hypothesis that has to do something with soil water. Now, we don't have that soil water, David. If there's soil water available, it may increase the conductance, and it may lead to some of that that you're seeing, too. But again, that's all hypothesis right now. But we're seeing some things that aren't fitting with the other FACE projects.
Must be wrong.
It must be wrong. Consistently wrong.
Did you say, Jeff, in 2008 there was a negative response?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was one. I won't try to explain that one. I'm not sure what would.
And that's the big fear.
Yeah, well, that's another.
Running out of water and failure, which is a real problem in mm-hmm. our part of the world.
Mm-hmm. Potential.
So we need to measure it.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Just asking you, if you could make a suggestion to breeders as to how to develop cultivars that would anticipate these changes, what would your recommendation be?
Yeah, well, that's our debate. We're debating that sort of all the time in our group here because. I'm not a plant breeder myself, but we aren't proposing to actually look at varietal lines or anything, but sort of gross traits, you know, like is it the tillering process or is it the number of seeds or, you know, what is it that's really responding and provide that information to some of the breeding programs. And I guess my question back to breeders might be, you know, what can you select for? Is it stomatal conductance that changes the water use efficiency, or is it root exploration, or sort of what is it, you know? I honestly will say we need more dialogue between the FACE people and the plant breeders and everything to understand better how our results can fit in and what the plant breeders might give to us, say, well, why don't you try this trait, that trait? We think they have at least a first order sort of effect on what's going on. It doesn't really answer your question, but certainly what we have found is tillering response is big. It's been found in rice as well, and that's something that can be bred for. The low tillering varieties don't have enough plasticity to respond to the CO2 we feel, and the high tillering varieties produce lots of very thin tillers that don't survive to maturity. The medium ones are sort of like Goldilocks; they're just right, And they have enough starch storage capability, et cetera, for those tillers to survive, and they produce more grain. So that's kind of what we're seeing. So it may be starch storage that you select for, and we're not sure about that yet, but that's another hypothesis. Yes?
Did you observe any root shoot ratio and elevated CO2 content?
We've looked at that. We have some data. 1 year we saw significant increases in root in the top 20 centimeters. The other second year we didn't see any, and the third year hasn't been analyzed yet.
Basically, it's not consistent.
So it's not consistent, but on the other hand, to really get at that, you'd have to poke a lot of holes out there, and we probably don't have, you know, we only have a limited number of samples because it's a small, it's a relatively small area, and we can't turn it into Swiss cheese, basically. So we have to sort of go on there year by year samples to build up a database, and we only have 2 years right now.
Thank you.
Yes.